All eyes are currently on President number 45. Donald Trump has a knack for making news day after day. Some of that just comes with the presidency. Ronald Reagan, President number 40, made plenty of news in his two terms in office, and he continues to get ink several years after his death. By some counts, Reagan is the subject of 1,000 biographies. Those include a new one by Craig Shirley called Reagan Rising, The Decisive Years, 1976 through 1980. Craig Shirley is the go-to person for Ronald Reagan information. This is now his fourth book on Reagan. Craig has been called the best of the Reagan biographers by the London Telegraph. He's a visiting Reagan scholar at Eureka College, Reagan's alma mater, and lectures frequently at the Reagan Library and Reagan Ranch. Just a chance to get acquainted here, Craig Shirley. What makes your stuff different from everything else out there?
Good morning, Jeff.
Hi.
I guess the best way I could put it is I write from ground level. Many historians write from 10,000 feet. They talk to, you know, political leaders, cabinet officers, senators, congressmen, noteworthy people. Whereas I approach these things by talking to the people who worked on the ground for the various campaigns and in the White Houses and at the networks and in national politics. You know, I talked to interview the people who ran phone banks in St. Louis, Missouri, and people like that. Because, you know, okay. Murray Kempton,
quick get to a break, Craig, and then we'll come back and talk with you a lot more. Reagan Rising is the book. Craig Shirley, the guest. We'll be back on The Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are just getting acquainted with Craig Shirley, a several times over biographer of Ronald Reagan. His latest book is called Reagan Rising, The Decisive Years, 1976 through 1980. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Craig, forgive my sloppy timekeeping that got us into that break when we did.
No worries.
So what you're saying is your approach is to talk to people who really got to know Ronald Reagan, worked in his campaigns, were around him in his immediate orbit.
Yes. Murray Kempton, the famous New York writer, once said that sometimes the best story is in the loser's locker room. So I've taken that to heart, but also to heart that sometimes the best story is told at ground level. So I think, you know, what I hope to achieve with my books, Jeff, is that to give the reader a real sense of a kind of a you are there moment, that you're not reading rarefied, air history, but real meaty, gritty, on-the-ground history.
Well, this book does concentrate on the period. Well, there was a loser locker room here because Ronald Reagan lost the 1976 nomination to Gerald Ford, and then he reached success 4 years later. Was there a time in that period when Reagan said, "That's it, no more running for president"?
I think no. As a matter of fact, there wasn't. After the 76 campaign, he and Mrs. Reagan had a dinner meeting at their home in California with his former campaign staff, to make it clear that even though he was 65 years old in 1976, he was going to be a candidate in 1980 for all intents and purposes. And his staff was very, very lukewarm to the idea. Only the original Californians were there for Reagan. Most of the rest of them drifted away to other candidates, you know, to George Bush and Howard Baker and others that they thought were younger, more moderate, could win the nomination and win the election in 1980. So it really is an example of how many times Reagan in his life, when he took control of his own destiny, was best off when he did, like with the Nashua debate in 1980, like with the debate with Jimmy Carter in the fall of 1980. Reagan's always best when he trusted his own judgment, and he was trusting his own judgment again, even though he was a two-time loser, having lost in 68 and 76.
So let's back up a step. Why did Reagan decide to challenge Ford, who was an incumbent, albeit an appointed incumbent, rather than close ranks and be the good party soldier?
Well, that's a great question. I am convinced, of course, as we all know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a celebrated world-renowned writer and a Nobel Prize winner in the early 70s. And, of course, you know, he'd been in the Gulag. He wrote One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, and had been imprisoned by the Soviets for writing critical letters about Joseph Stalin in the 1940s. But there was too much international attention paid to him by the 60s and the 70s, so the Soviets just couldn't, eliminate him. So he was released to the West. And it was interesting because he was officially welcomed to Washington, D.C., by Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina and Senator Joe Biden of Delaware. It was bipartisan welcoming ceremony for Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Reagan welcomed him unofficially in columns and writings and things like that. But when Gerald Ford refused to meet with Solzhenitsyn at the recommendation of then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger for fear it would antagonize the Kremlin, Reagan was infuriated. He just saw it as a knuckling under to the Kremlin, and I'm quite sure that was the moment where Reagan decided to take on Gerald Ford. He had little regard for Ford's political skills or his leadership skills. And, you know, of course, Ford was an unelected president and had very little psychic hold on the American people because nobody had ever cast a vote for him, so, except for one congressional district in Maryland or Michigan. So he had, and he followed Richard Nixon's policies of detente and appointing liberal jurists to the court and his economic policies and such and such. And there was just a hue and cry among the conservatives in the party for Reagan to take on Gerald Ford. And so he was reluctant until Solzhenitsyn. And then a couple days later, he was on a plane with Mike Deaver, his young aide at the time. And a woman got on the plane and embraced him and said, "Oh, Governor, you've just got to run." And he turned to Mike and he said, "Well, I guess I better do it."
Easily convinced, but I guess he didn't need much convincing.
He saw himself as a leader among men. You know, what's interesting is that his inspiration in some ways was Douglas MacArthur, whereas Gerald Ford's inspiration was Harry Truman. And in fact, when Ford became president, he had Harry Truman's portrait installed in the cabinet room of the White House, which a lot of people found interesting because, of course, Truman was a Democrat and Ford was a Republican. But he saw himself very Truman-esque. He saw himself as a plain-spoken man of the Midwest who was fiercely partisan but willing to reach out across to the other side when necessary. But he saw himself as more Truman-esque than he did, say, you know, Coolidge or some other more conservative president. Whereas Reagan would quote Douglas MacArthur, and of course, as we all know, is that MacArthur and Truman hated each other. So I think that's a kind of a parable for the political tale of Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, is that they didn't have much use for each other either.
Craig Shirley is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a Reagan biographer, now on his fourth biography, this one called Reagan Rising, The Decisive Years, 1976 to 1980. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 with memories of Ronald Reagan or questions for the author. Also join us by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Gerald Ford was gracious at the 76 convention, which he left as the nominee of the Republican Party, and in letting Reagan speak. And how important was that speech?
Well, it was very important. It was more important for Ronald Reagan than it was for Gerald Ford, and it didn't turn out the way the Ford forces wanted it to. Ford was, as we all know, was not a very good public speaker, but he'd given an uncharacteristically good speech in accepting the Republican nomination in Kemper Arena in Kansas City. But he's presiding over a divided party, a badly divided party, because Reagan has only lost the nomination by 67 delegate votes out of 2,269 cast the day before. So he knows he needs to unify the party, and the best way to do so is to ask former Governor Ronald Reagan to come down from the skybox and say a few words, and Reagan is very reluctant. In fact, he'd done an interview with Tom Brokaw just a few minutes earlier. Brokaw, an NBC reporter, had asked, "Governor, are you going to address the convention?" And Reagan said no. And then after Ford speaks, and then he goes, gives an impromptu call for Reagan to come down, 17,000 people in Kemper Arena are all yelling, you know, "Reagan, Reagan, Reagan, we want Ron, we want Ron." And the whole Ford family's on the dais all waving for Reagan to come down. So he's very reluctant to make his way to the podium. But he gives what I consider to be one of his two most important political speeches, the other being the 64 speech for Barry Goldwater, because this speech really is not about conceding the nomination. It's not about Gerald Ford. It's really about Ronald Reagan and Ronald Reagan's relationship with the American people. And he's talking about war, peace, and the future, things very much on his mind. And he leaves there with a greater outpouring of affection from the 17,000 faithful there than did Gerald Ford. As a matter of fact, a Reagan aide was standing on the, he told me this, he was standing on the floor of the convention, and this woman is listening as Reagan gives a speech. This woman is a big-time Ford supporter, he described her as. And after Reagan speaks, she says in a loud voice, "Oh, my God, we've nominated the wrong man."
And, in fact, Gerald Ford went on to lose to Jimmy Carter in November 1976. And just to get an idea of how different those times were, you write that the GOP was not dead after the 76 campaign, but certainly on life support. What was the general state of the party at that time?
Oh, it was atrocious. Is that it was raising so little money that for 3 weeks in December of 75, the Republican National Committee had to close its offices just to save on the electricity bill. They'd cut their staff down to the bare bones. And of course, we know the Democrats overwhelmingly controlled the Senate. They overwhelmingly controlled the House. 49 out of 50 states had near or total Democratic control of the state government. Only Kansas had Republican control of the governorship and the state legislature, but the other 49 states were near or total Democratic control. 11% of voters under 30 identified with the Republican Party. And, you know, if a party is about the future, you can't build a future with only 11% of the electorate. The party was, for all intents and purposes, dead as a political force in America.
Well, as we've seen several times now, right, you know, people writing the Republican Party off as, well, it's just a regional party now, that sort of thing.
That's exactly right. Doesn't stay
dead for long. So who did GOP leaders think was going to be the likely 1980 candidate after that 76 loss?
Well, the smart money was on anybody but Ronald Reagan. It was on John Connally, because a lot of people thought he looked like a president. It was on Howard Baker. You know, the Washington insiders thought Howard Baker, you know, Howard Baker was smooth. He was handsome. He was a good public speaker. He was from a border state. He was a very good man. I knew Senator Baker not well, but I knew him well enough to know that he was a very good man, and later joined the Reagan administration. But he had gotten a foul with conservatives because he had supported the Panama Canal treaties, and that was just the hottest of hot button issues of 1977, 1978. It was everything was judged through the prism of support or opposition of the Panama Canal treaties. It was truly a populist uprising in America. When I interviewed President Carter, he very astutely pointed out that every senator who voted for the Panama Canal treaties in 77, who was up for re-election in 78 and 80, lost. And he's convinced they lost because they voted for the treaties. It was that much of a populist uprising against the what was known as the giveaway of the Panama Canal treaties.
And Carter, as you point out, actually reached out to Reagan in the run-up to the Panama Canal Treaty. What was he trying to get?
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. He wanted his support. And so the White House accorded. You know, it's interesting. It's just that there wasn't a lot of they didn't know each other well. When I asked President Carter if he had met Reagan, he said he met him at a couple of governor's conferences, but they didn't know each other well. But there was respect for each other's political talents because they were both, in many ways, outsiders to the Washington system, disgusted with the Washington system, and they both were populist. Carter was a populist of the Southern agrarian in the Jeffersonian mold, and Reagan was a populist of the Midwest in the William Jennings Bryan mold. Both were suspicious of bigness. They were suspicious of Washington lobbyists, Washington corporations, Washington, the Washington government. Is that Reagan's first column, which of course he wrote twice a week for King Features Syndicates for many years, his first column in January of 1977 argued for giving Jimmy Carter a chance. It was a message to conservatives. So there was certainly, at least in the early days, there was mutual respect for each other's political talents and a kinship in their attitude toward Washington.
We're talking about Ronald Reagan in the years between his loss of the Republican nomination in 1976 and his gaining it and the White House in 1980. The book is called Reagan Rising, The Decisive Years, 1976-1980. Craig Shirley, the author of now four Reagan biographies, our guest on The Exchange. You can join in at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So here was Ronald Reagan saying, let's give Jimmy Carter a chance. Now, but in February of 1977, just a few weeks into the Carter administration, there was already a CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, and Reagan addressed it in February. How much was that noticed at the time by either the media or the leaders of the two parties?
it was not noticed by anybody. It was not noticed by the Washington media. I think the Washington Post was there and the New York Times was there, but they report. It was a very brief reporting of it. It was more about the politics of the convention, of the conference, than it was about Reagan's speech. Of course, those are the days, you know, I've been involved with CPAC for 40 years, attending, speaking, helping organize, whatever. My wife ran it. My wife, Serene, ran it for 4 years, so we were intimately familiar with CPAC. And in those days, is that the conservative movement was quite separate, distinct, and apart from the Republican Party. So you didn't get the chairman of the Republican National Committee speaking at CPAC. You didn't get, you know, Howard Baker or people like that speaking at CPAC. You got conservatives like Phil Crane and Jesse Helms. But most of the speakers were outside the political system. There were governors or you know, columnists, heads of conservative organizations, and, of course, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan spoke at every CPAC from the first one in 1973 to right up to 1988, his last year in the presidency. The only two CPACs he missed were 1976 because he was campaigning in New Hampshire, and again in 1980 because he was campaigning in New Hampshire. But he attended. So in many ways, CPAC was invented for Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan invented CPAC.
Some of these stories of what would seem like very strange bedfellows, too, though, about the same time. Ronald Reagan and Eugene McCarthy appearing together in June of 1977, and then Jesse Jackson.
Right.
Jesse Jackson at a GOP gathering in early 78.
Yes.
What was going on there?
Well, that was a smart attempt by Bill Brock, who was then the chairman of the Republican National Committee, to make a sincere effort to reach out to African-American voters. And so this was why Jesse Jackson was asked to be a dinner speaker at this Republican confab. And there was a very, very, you know, in fact, I think, if you'll recall, Jesse Jackson wrote some articles for some Republican publications, which were well received. Jackson was different then. He was, as you may know, he was campaigning in the inner cities, telling young African Americans to hit the books, to stay away, to go to bed on time, to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Basically, everything that resonates with conservatives about self-initiative and self-determination, he was telling young African Americans. It was a very conservative message, although he would never identify himself as a conservative. It was a conservative message. This was noticed by the Republican Party. So there was a nexus between what he was telling African-Americans in the inner cities and what the Republican Party was was preaching as its philosophy. So it seemed like a natural alliance. It did. It petered out, unfortunately. But it was a sincere attempt to try to bring more African-Americans into the Republican Party.
So from that outreach, and that was probably the pinnacle of the outreach of the GOP to black Americans in that period, I mean, why then did Ronald Reagan announce his candidacy deep in Mississippi as a states' rights candidate?
Well, he didn't. He didn't. That's been a myth I've been fighting for 20 years, 30 years. He didn't. He announced his fall campaign was launched at Liberty State Park in New Jersey, and Lech Walesa's father was there. It was.
His primary campaign in Neshoba County, Mississippi?
No. He went to Neshoba County. He had been invited, and he promised them. It wasn't that. It was the issue. Really, of course, what we're talking about was that four civil rights leaders or civil rights activists were killed near Neshoba County. Yeah, there in 1961, 62, and so it became kind of a hot button, or a better way to describe it, for politics. Although Michael Dukakis campaigned in Neshoba County in 1988 when he was running for president, so, and a lot of other Democrats had campaigned, and of course Jimmy Carter launched his fall campaign near the birthplace of the KKK in Pulaski, Tennessee. So I mean, it was just. No matter where you went in the South, you were going to, you know, is that the radiation emanated from its history with the KKK and its history with racism. And yet Carter was elected in 76, running as a man of the, agrarian man of the South. So it was a very difficult issue to navigate. And the best thing to do was simply to confront it, which is what both Carter and Reagan did, I think, to both of their credit, instead of to now it's in the South running away from it, is that they both argued for the South to, you know, to move on and accept its past and make amends.
We've talked a bit about the Solzhenitsyn effect on Ronald Reagan and the fact that that he was determined that he was going to be tougher on the Soviet Union, which still existed, than Gerald Ford certainly, and certainly yes. than Jimmy Carter. I mean, so a big security context at the time, very much talking about strength in America, which when defense is obviously a duty of government. I'm just trying to put together the parts here, how such an anti-government tide rose in the years before Reagan officially even became a candidate again in the midst of all this talk about strengthening defense.
You know, it's, Americans had had a healthy regard for their government, you know, from the 1800s, and then especially with the rise of the New Deal. Now, historians will argue the New Deal did not solve the Great Depression. However, it did give the American people hope, and that was something that was lacking in 1931 and 1932. Government certainly defeated the Empire of Japan and Nazi Germany. Government built the interstate highway system. But beginning in the 1960s, with the assassination of John Kennedy, President Kennedy, government starts failing. Government can't save Martin Luther King. Government can't save Robert Kennedy. Government can't win the Vietnam War. Government can't stop hyperinflation, hyperinterest rates. Government can't stop gas lines. By the 1970s, is that and this is why Carter was elected. Of course, the government was out of control under Richard Nixon because of the excesses of the CIA and the FBI and his own White House, and that's how Carter was elected. Was about reforming government and shrinking government and bringing it down to a manageable size. So as I said before, he was plowing the same populist field in many ways as Ronald Reagan, more liberal populist field, but certainly still anti-bigness, which is at the core of American populism. This creates the environment, the fertile ground, into which Reagan can make his case for federalism, or what we talked about earlier, the speech at CPAC calling for a new Republican Party. It was based on the individual. It was based on, you know, he rejected, he said the Republican Party needs to reject its image of corporate boardrooms and country clubs and needs to embrace the individual, the cop on the street, the homemaker, the farmer, and we must never allow the group, never allow the group to dictate and cater to those things that are more important to the individual. So I mean, it's a confluence of many things that are going on, Jeff, at the time. Is that America's standing in the world, America's government, the economy, the national malaise. I mean, Carter was right, although he never said it in 1979 at the now famous speech.
Right.
But there was a malaise in the foot in the land. So all these happenstances of history create a confluence that leads to the revolutionary election of Ronald Reagan. Reagan might never have been elected in any other time in American history, but in 1980, his campaign slogan was "The time is now for Reagan." Because I think even he understood that and he said at the time, he said, you know, when in regard to Goldwater, he said he was ahead of his time, and I think he really believed that. But I think he really believed too that his time had come and his message had come by 1980.
Yeah, and 16 years after Goldwater ran, there was the opportunity, and Ronald Reagan seized it and blew into the White House, leading a conservative tide. Some similarities, certainly, in things that have happened since. Reagan certainly paved the way, it can be argued, for the blowout in 1994 that pretty much swept Democrats out of the South. The book is called Reagan Rising, The Decisive Years, 1976-1980. It is the fourth biography of Ronald Reagan by Craig Shirley. Craig, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Oh, Jeff, thank you so much. It was great.